Let me call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:37 p.m. on Tuesday, May 2nd, 2017. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz filling in for Representative Pruitt. Today is Representative Newman, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Gren, Guttenberg, Thompson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. Before we start, just a reminder, folks could please mute their cell phones, and Representative Pruitt is excused. At this meeting, we'll be having testimony from Diane Kaplan. Somebody will be reading a letter from her, I believe, Jane Pearson from my office. She, of course, is with the Rasmussen Foundation, and then we also have Trevor Storrs, Executive Director of the Alaska Children's Trust, to discuss Alaska's fiscal options and the effects on children, families, and households. Also with Mr. Storrs is Jonathan King with Northern Economics. He co-authored the Northern Economics Study for the Children's Trust. And then our next presenter will be Lori Wolf, President and CEO of Foraker Group. Lori is here to present to the committee on the effects of the current recession on the nonprofit community. And then next we will hear from Natasha Singh of the Tanana Chiefs Conference and Grace Singh of the Central Council Tlingit and Haida. And then finally, our last piece of business today is SB 107, the Capital Income Fund Bill. And so with that, I'd like to call my aide, Jane Pearson, to the table to read into the record a statement from Diane Kaplan, President and CEO of the Rasmussen Foundation. And I'd also like to note that Speaker of the House, Representative Bryce Edgman, is here with us. And with that, if you could put yourself on the record, Jane.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Neil Foster, and I'm going to read Diane Kaplan's, President and CEO of the Rasmussen Foundation, her statement into the record. Dear Chairman and House Finance Committee members, for the record, my name is Diane Kaplan, President and CEO of the Rasmussen Foundation and a longtime Alaskan and resident of Anchorage. I write today to offer my sincere appreciation and support of the efforts of this committee and to all members of the Alaska Legislature on both sides of the aisle and in both bodies, as well as to the governor for nearly universal recognition that the state's fiscal challenges must be addressed this session. With our saving balance now below $5 billion, less than 2 years' worth of deficits, we have to take meaningful action. Alaskans are expecting a solution that will take uncertainty out of their future. A comprehensive solution can happen this session, and the elements needed are all within your reach. A long overdue restructure of the permanent fund into a percent of market value, PMOV model, that both preserves the dividend and uses earnings to support the state's general fund, combined with a new broad-based revenue source, sensible budget reductions, and a revision to the state's oil and gas production tax credit system into one that encourages investment and production while also taking into account the necessity of a long-term fiscal sustainability. Each and every one of these elements is realistic. Alaskans know the schools their children attend, the roads they drive, and the airports they rely on do not come free. It is time for all of us to participate in making the state economically healthy and successful. We're all in it together, and the time is now to make sure our children and grandchildren have the same opportunities we have all had in this great state. I implore you to give Alaskans the budget solutions they are counting on. The decisions will not be easy, but Alaskans support you and are relying on you to make the right choices. Thank you. Diane Kaplan, President and CEO of the Rasmussen Foundation.
Thank you, Ms. Pearson. Let's next move to Trevor Storrs. He's online. He's the Executive Director of the Trust, as well as Jonathan King of Northern Economics. He co-authored the Northern Economic Study for the Children's Trust. And so, Mr. Storrs and Mr. King, if you could please put yourselves on the record and also your affiliations. And I believe we have a PowerPoint here. And so with that, since we do have two male voices online, prior to speaking, if each of you could just identify yourselves, and if you could go ahead and put yourselves on the record.
Absolutely. This is Trevor Storrs with Alaska Children's Trust. I'll be the primary speaker, unless there are specific questions related to the study that Mr. King helped author. He will remain silent.
This is Jonathan King, Vice President with Northern Economics, and as Mr. Storrs noted, we'll only be addressing questions related to the economic study.
Okay, please proceed.
Great. Well, thank you all for this opportunity to testify today. Our testimony today is to provide a nonpartisan voice. We recognize our state as an important crossroads. Our goal today is to share an additional perspective and data to help you determine the best way to address our fiscal gap for all Alaskans. ACT does not endorse one idea or concept over another. We just hope this data will help guide us all towards a solution that ensures the future of our children. The size of the Alaska state budget shortfall ensures that balancing the state budget will be costly no matter what measures are taken. However, as the statewide lead organization focused on the prevention of child abuse and neglect, our focus is on ensuring our most vulnerable and most valuable resource, our children, continue to grow up in safe, stable, and nurturing environments. As our state struggles to find a solution to the nearly $3 billion fiscal gap, we know the best return on investment is to invest earlier than later. Next slide, please. Jane Peckman, a Nobel laureate economist, has shown that for every dollar we invest in early childhood, we save taxpayers up to $7 long-term. Peckman says, in an area of tight government budgets, the real question is how to use the available funds wisely. The best evidence supports the policy prescription, invest in the very young. Next slide. Over the past decade, we have come to understand one of the most effective ways of preventing child abuse and neglect is by addressing the social determinants that foster an environment that promotes trauma and does not build the resilience necessary to manage it. One of the key social determinants that influence a family's ability to ensure a child grows up in a safe, stable, and nurturing environment is economics. Research shows that families who live in poverty are at greater risk of neglecting their children. While poverty is widely recognized as a risk factor in abuse and neglect cases, it is by no means a cause of abuse and neglect. Next slide, please. In Alaska, of the approximately 3,000 children in OCS care, 80% met the standard to be the Title IV-E eligible, meaning that the family met the income limits to be eligible for aid to families with dependent children. In other words, most are likely, if not all of them, would be classified as living in poverty. Next slide, please. When the amount and intensity of risk factors outweigh the amount and intensity of protective factors, child abuse and neglect can occur. A family's level of fiscal stability plays a major role. When stressors like no access to mental health treatment, medical services, living on the verge of being evicted, or holding down two jobs outweighs their ability to cope, no one should be surprised that child abuse or other interpersonal violence or issues can occur. It is with this understanding that the Children's Trust commissioned two reports related to the potential revenue sources and or plans to address the state's fiscal gap. Both reports were written utilizing a child and family lens. Prior to these reports, little attention was given to how the fiscal gap and potential solutions would impact children and families. Next slide, please. You've been provided a copy of both reports. Our first report was titled Effect of Alaska Fiscal Option on Children and Families, authored by ICER. A follow-up report was titled Analysis of State Fiscal Plans, authored by Northern Economics. Although both reports were commissioned by the Alaska Children's Trust, the authors were 100% independent, impartial, and nonpartisan. They utilized sound, rigorous, and objective science to complete their analysis and conclusion. The Children's Trust recognizes that children and families are impacted by the state budget. The goal of providing these two reports is to provide accurate data to our legislators to help ensure we develop a sustainable long-term fiscal plan that does not put greater strain on our most vulnerable families that could result in greater crisis like increase of child abuse and neglect, domestic violence, substance abuse, entering the correctional system, and the list goes on. Next slide, please. So the effect of Alaska fiscal options on children and families, authored by ICER, examined the estimate, or I should say, by ICER, estimated how several revenue-raising measures, three kinds of taxes, and a cut in the PSD would affect households with and without children. The report did not estimate effects on spending cuts. This study extends the previous analysis completed by ICER by specifically examining how the different options would be likely to affect families and children. Next slide, please. The report has three key findings. First, a cut in PSD would be far the costliest measure for Alaskan families. Households with children would pay about 2.5 times more per person than those without children for every $100 million of revenue raised. A reduction in PSD payout is much more costly to families, both when measured as an absolute or as the percentage loss of per capita disposable household income. It is just as costly for urban as it is for rural families and has by far the largest impact on low-income families. Second finding, next cost list would be a sales tax. Sales tax taxes cost families with children over 50% more than persons than the graduated income tax per dollar of revenue raised. And then finally, all measures except the graduated income tax would cost households with children more of their pre-person income than those without children. The report did not outline potential impacts of further cuts. ICER stated, while it's clear some cuts will directly affect children, many other programs, from public safety to transportation, benefit all households. It's impossible to compare how cuts in such programs would affect those and without children. Next slide, please. With the Governor, Senate, and House releasing their plan to address the fiscal gap, ACT commissioned a second report to use the data from the first report by ICER and to use the children and family lens to examine the impact of each plan on children and families. This report was completed by Northern Economics. ICER did not complete this report due to time constraints. The results of the analysis included all three plans place a significantly higher burden as a percentage of income on lower income households. The difference is most pronounced under SB 26 in the governor's plan. The difference in percentage of lost income between the bottom quartile and the top quartile for two adults with children home is nearly 9 extra percentage points under the Senate and governor's plan, whereas under the House plan, there's just a 3 percentage point increase. The reason for each plan placing a significant higher burden on lower income is based on the first report's finding that households with children would pay about 2.5 times more per person than those without children. This report did address the potential impact of further budget cuts. It stated more budget cuts could impact the overall economy, causing reductions in indirect and induced jobs, labor income, and economic output. As previously noted by ICER, estimated direct work reduction at nearly 1,700 jobs per 100 million in cuts. Next slide, please. The impact our most vulnerable families could experience translate into the opposite goal we all have, a strong fiscal budget. So a key component that needs to be discussed when addressing the fiscal gap is demand for services. With further cuts or new revenue sources, the demand will not change unless we ensure three things. Services are available to all Alaskans no matter their socioeconomic status. Two, truly investing in early childhood development, i.e. going upstream. And then lastly, ensuring the level of adverse childhood experiences in Alaska is decreased, resulting less of a demand. If we implement a fiscal plan that places a greater burden on our most vulnerable families, we will most likely increase demand, resulting in greater costs and making the issues we are faced with today more severe. So the graph you're looking currently shows that Alaska has lower rates of adults reporting zero ACEs. And I'm making the assumption from all my education with you all that you're very familiar with adverse childhood experiences, and that there are a higher rate of adults reporting high ACE scores. There was approximately 550,000 adults in the last 2013. So each percentage point represents about 5,500 Alaskan adults. Next slide, please. So who are these people with ACEs score, especially since we're talking about the most vulnerable low income? Four categories of income that you see above are displayed for Alaskan adults with 0 and 4+ ACEs. The Alaskan adults with 4+ ACEs are approximately twice as likely to make less than $20,000 per year than their peers with 0 ACEs. These individuals utilize a much higher percentage of services. This chart also shows that people with high ACE scores are the working poor. So with high ACE scores comes high costs. Estimated lifetime cost per Alaskan victim of child abuse neglect is nearly $230,000. You see above, 41% of the Medicaid enrollment in Alaska can be linked back to ACEs with a cost of around $360 million. 32% of Alaskan smokers likely smoke due to ACEs with a cost of $190 million. 24% of diabetes cases are linked with ACEs with a cost of $110 million. 14% of obesity cases in Alaska are linked to ACEs with a cost of $31 million. And lastly, 11% of binge drinking is linked with ACEs with a cost of $70 million. As you can see, if we put greater strain on lower income families who have the higher ACEs and lowest access to services financially, we will see demand and cost for services increase, which can greatly impact our state budget and would quickly put us back in the same debate. In conclusion, I want to reiterate that we recognize the legislature has a tough decision before them to address the fiscal gap. The size of Alaska's state budget shortfall ensures that balancing the state budget will be costly no matter what measures are taken. Our goal of these reports and our presentation today is to ensure legislators have accurate data and learn how our most vulnerable families could be impacted. Our hope is when a decision is made, the same children and families lens is utilized. I thank you for this opportunity, and we're available for any questions related to the presentation or the reports.
Thank you. Does the committee have any questions? We've got a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we kind of talked about this a little bit yesterday, just taking this as one item. So as you're looking at the income in different areas of the state, can you show the difference in the impact if I'm in a, and I'll use North Pole as an example, we have property tax and sales tax, then the PFD cut last year, and then possibly these other taxes we talked about yesterday, compared to, let's say, Delta, and nothing against Delta, but just nearest community that doesn't have property tax, doesn't have sales tax. So a family making $15,000 a year living in North Pole versus Delta, how do we look at what different options we have and how that would affect a family in those two different areas without those additional taxes that are being paid?
I'm going to ask Jonathan to respond to that as the economist.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson. The ISA report, which is the basis for our analysis, really looks at the effect of state-level taxes. And so whether you're in Dulles Junction or you're in the Fairbanks North Star Borough, the reduced incomes from the plans is the same. Now, one could argue that because the Fairbanks North Star Borough family is already paying taxes, that perhaps they have less ability to adapt than, say, the Delta Junction family, all other things being equal. You could certainly think about that. But the purpose of the ICER analysis was really to look at those state-level changes, and it didn't look at the local tax burden that was already on those families. And so think about this as additional state burden above and beyond what's occurring at the local level.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
But when those families who already have those other taxes, the breaking point for those families would be much different than those that do not have that burden.
Through the Chairman, Representative Wilson, while we cannot say we can't say definitively that that's the case, I think that there is a certain strength of logic there. That yes, I mean, if you're if you're in an area where you're already under that level of fiscal stress or you're already contributing, all other things being equal, that, you know, cost of living and those sorts of things, that you would be closer to the breaking point. That being said, you have to think about things like utility rates and the cost of providing for housing and the cost of fuel for heating the home. But yeah, somebody living in a higher cost environment making the same amount of money compared to somebody in a lower cost environment will be closer to the breaking point. And I think there's a strength to your logic there.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
So with a childhood adverse experience and I think you're 80% as far as those being in poverty with OCS is probably low. So again, talking about those in the different environments, wouldn't the poverty level somewhat change because it wouldn't be now just based on how much money I make from the job I am in, but how much money I'm able to keep within the household?
Well, poverty is the poverty line would be defined on a federal level, and there's a standard formula that would be applied to all individuals, so that would not change.
We'll follow up.
Follow up.
I understand the poverty level in itself would not change, but when we're talking about how much money a family makes and the pressure it puts on that family unit, again, if we're talking about, so let's say the poverty level is $22,000 a year, just, you know, for an amount, and one family already has $5,000 taken out because of other taxes are there versus another family, and then I add this on, couldn't I actually be, as far as how much money I have to spend, not necessarily what it is by the federal level, but by spendable income, could it not put me down to where I will be at risk for exactly what the Children's Trust is trying to prevent?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes. As indicated by Mr. King, the logic is there. We have not done that study or that kind of analysis, but there's some good logic to the process that you just outlined.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Grin.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Question for Mr. Storrs. I know that the two studies don't relate to and don't talk about the cuts, but could you talk maybe quickly, anecdotally, about the groups and clients that ACT works with and serves regarding the cuts over the past few years? What's happening to your clients or to the groups that you work with?
Through the chair, what I can respond to is the conversations. We have not done a specific survey or collection of data around that. But a lot of what we have noticed is, one, we are actually a funder, if many of you remember. We have seen the types of requests that we have been receiving for funding increase. Through many of those applications, one of the primary reasons of seeking of funding is stated as because of decrease of funding available through the state, and that without this additional funding, the individuals that they are currently serving are at jeopardy of losing services. We know that people are being limited in overall numbers that they are able to take in. The impacting also has on their staffing. They're being able to staff at an appropriate level to truly provide services is usually an issue, as well as just being able to offer appropriate wages so we can actually hire individuals into those positions. So I think Ms. Wolf will be really much getting into the nonprofit side of things. But one of the things to remember around nonprofits, there was a statement once made just recently that we are part of this discussion is because we see this as another way of fundraising for ourselves, and that is far from the truth. Nonprofits, especially the ones that we serve, that work with the families and children, they are the safety net. They are the ones that are working diligently to lessen the ACEs and ensure our families have the resources to be actively engaged and productive in our community. And without them, without that safety net, it's a person like walking the tightrope. When they fall, they're no longer caught, and we know what the tragedy then is. So many of our nonprofits are really trying to piece things together, and they're really holding on, several of them, by shoestrings.
Thank you. We've got a question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've got a jobs question for Mr. King, but first, Trevor, thanks for all your work for children, by the way. And I've got a question, but like Representative Grant, I'm not sure if you can answer it, so don't answer it if you feel like you can't. One of the budget proposals before us for the office that works with our abused and neglected children, the Office of Children's Services, one of the proposals before the legislature would include a 2.5% cut to the Office of Children's Services and the elimination of state-funded pre-K. Are those things that you feel comfortable commenting on? And if not, don't worry about it.
We have, thank you, through the chair, Representative Garrett. We have actually testified on both of them. So first with the pre-K, if we remember with the second slide that was presented dealing with James Heckman, we know that, again, when we invest a dollar in early childhood, it saves taxpayers $7 long-term. So the best return is actually on prenatal, and then it's early childhood development. So we greatly support that kind of investment. Again, if we really want to make a difference, it's about not about spending more. It's about using our available funds wisely. And the more that we can start shifting this money upstream to early childhood development, evidence shows that that is the best prescription, as Heckman said. It's investment in the very young. Alaska's early pre-K programs also reduces below age performance by 80%. And then in the sense of OCS, we know banks are dealing with some of the most struggling families, both economically as well as within trauma. We also know they have larger than expected caseloads on the national average and or as what is prescribed. And we want them to effectively achieve to protect our children and reunite the families and support the families. Our goal is not to have children removed from families, but to be protected. And if we truly want to see that number down, we need to invest in it. It's like trying to ask the police to effectively deal with crime, but not with enough officers. We need OCS to have the resources at their disposal, to effectively do what we need them to do, which is protect kids, and then at all costs, trying to reunite them with the families so they can be successful and not come back into the OCS system. We commissioned a report nearly 2 years ago that talked about the recidivism within the OCS system, and please don't quote me, I don't have the report, but I want to say it was between 75 and 85% of the OCS cases are individuals that were part of the system prior to. So it's a high level of percentage. If we could change that recidivism, we could greatly impact OCS numbers, which in time would actually allow us to do an appropriate reduction because they no longer need the funds because we've actually addressed the issue.
Thanks, Mr. Storrs. And then, Mr. King, I've got a question or two for you. Are you there?
I am, Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. King, in an earlier report that you gave us this year, and I mean, we're at the point in the legislative session where There's one proposal that has smaller cuts and one proposal that has larger cuts to the budget, including cuts to education and the university, and as you heard, the Office of Children's Services and other things. And you had an analysis on in the earlier study on what level of cuts cause what level of job losses. I guess there is one proposal that we hear about that says over 3 years, some folks in the legislature are looking for $750 million more in cuts. Do you have any? Can you give us your analysis of what that might do to jobs, private and public sector jobs?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, I will actually be in front of you on Friday comparing the two current plans or analogous scenarios to the two current plans and answering that exact question. But if you go back to our prior analysis and you look at that, we modeled a roughly $1 billion cut to the unrestricted general fund. And we saw that would result in an additional, I think it was 10,000 lost jobs. We would end up with a peak to trough of 34,000 lost jobs versus, 20 to 24,000 lost jobs with that $1 billion scenario. So if you had a $750 million cut peak to trough, we'd probably be looking at that, in the 28 to 30,000 job range. With 5,000 to 7,000 of that being additional jobs over kind of what we consider the status quo, but I'll be speaking to that I think in greater detail relative to the plans on the table on Friday in front of your committee.
Through the chair, just briefly,
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, and Mr. King, and when you say that loss of jobs at 7,500 jobs that would be lost, those I take it are both private sector and public sector?
Yes, through the chair. Representative Garrett, a good rule of thumb that you can safely use is that for every 10 public sector jobs that you cut, we're going to lose anywhere from 5 to 7 private sector jobs. So you can use 6 as a rule of thumb very safely.
All right, thank you.
Hey, do we have any questions of the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Storrs and Mr. King. We'll now move on to our next presentation, and that is Lori Wolf. And Lori is the president and CEO of the Foraker Group. If you could go ahead and put yourself on the record, and it looks like we have a PowerPoint presentation, and thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Lori Wolf. I am the president and CEO of the Foraker Group, where I have worked since its near inception 17 years ago. I am a lifelong Alaskan, born on Elmendorf Air Force Base and raised in Anchorage. And I have spent my entire adult career working, leading, and studying in the nonprofit sector. So as some of you know, the Foraker Group is a nonprofit. Our goal is to strengthen nonprofits across the state of Alaska. We include tribal governments in that. We're deeply grounded in our core values, and we are driven by our four lines of business, many of which you know, but we provide a whole range of educational opportunities. We've educated over 10,000 boards and staff across Alaska. We provide organizational development, which is what the rest of the world would call consulting. We provide shared services or backroom consolidated services to help nonprofits be the most effective and efficient with their resource and be able to focus on mission. And we are the state nonprofit association for Alaska. Not every state has a nonprofit state association, but Alaska does, and we are it. And what that means is that we provide a research and public policy voice on behalf of the nonprofit sector. To clear up any confusion, which we've heard a little bit of in the last couple weeks, Foraker is an independent nonprofit, a 501c3 organization. We are separate from the Rasmussen Foundation and the Alaska Community Foundation, although we are certainly pleased to partner with both of these organizations on a variety of projects that strengthen the nonprofit sector and the health of our communities. We often hear people think that we are one and the same organization, and so to be clear, today I am speaking on behalf of the 4-Acre Group. 4-Acre is well respected across the state as a neutral, nonpartisan, and apolitical statewide organization. We serve all types of nonprofits, and we have a strong track record of working with all levels of government. Today, I am here to speak on behalf of the economic impact of the nonprofit sector on the state. So literally, nonprofits are a part of everyday life in Alaska, but we can often feel and seem slightly invisible. We are so embedded in the Alaska nonprofit landscape that it's sometimes hard to see us holding up the safety net or providing the critical service or driving economic development in a community. But we fill the gap between government services, the marketplace, and the critical needs of our communities. In our state, we talk about industries, not about who does the work. So for example, when we talk about fisheries, we talk about the fishermen, but not about the nonprofit aquaculture organizations. Or in the oil industry, we don't talk about the nonprofit oil spill response agencies or the trade associations. Or in tourism, we miss all the nonprofit recreation and education providers. As Alaskans, we need to do a better job at understanding our interconnectedness and build on each other's strengths. So most people recognize the charitable 501c3 organizations as a sector, but it is important to recognize that we are bigger than that. So you'll recognize your favorite nonprofits in this slide. And so this is a fairly accurate representation of where we stand today. It's a couple of years old, but we don't change that dramatically. So you can see how the composition of our nonprofits look across the state. As part of the state association, we do conduct an economic impact study every 3 years. And we do this in partnership with ICER, but we also do a lot of the work ourselves. And so we are in the process of redoing this study right now for 2017. What I'm going to share with you today is the previous study. And when we did that study, it is important to note that the state was not in the current economic position it is in today, but the issues are still the same. So we were joking earlier that these numbers don't often speak for themselves because hardly anybody recognizes that these numbers are true and alive in our Alaska nonprofit life and in our state. So truly, Alaska nonprofit sector does have an economic impact that is significant in our state. We are $4.4 billion in direct expenditures by our charitable, those are our 501c3 organizations, and $2.1 billion in direct expenditures by all other nonprofits. And so that's a $6.5 billion direct expenditures by all nonprofits in the state. We also employ 39,000 employees across the state of Alaska. When we take that 39,000 jobs, and we use a standard economic multiplier, you can begin to see the larger impact that our nonprofit sector is having on our state and the economy that we live in. So our 39,000 jobs turn into 63,000 jobs across the state of Alaska. In comparison, these should feel familiar to you. In comparison, if we, you can see how the nonprofit sector stacks up to the oil industry or the fishing industry. And just like people, just like the people in these industries that are concerned about the economy, so are we. And we hope that you are also concerned about the sector and thinking about how your fiscal policies impact the nonprofit sector as you make decisions. Perhaps the most significant understanding of how we impact the jobs across the state of Alaska is to look at this distribution. Again, by comparison, it's good to know that in the U.S., the nonprofit sector makes up about 10.6% of the workforce, and on average across Alaska, we're at 12%. But you can see the more rural the area and the more significant the impact we have on jobs across Alaska. When we look at how money comes into the sector, there is good news, and of course there is challenge in this current data that you see in front of you. Just for reference, the horizontal lines across your screen are the national averages. We are watching, and we have been watching, as federal funds have been declining coming into our nonprofit sector. And we are also watching that earned revenue, mission-related business income, is actually on the rise for our nonprofits. So there is both challenging news and there is good news. And while those charitable contribution numbers may seem low, it is important to recognize that Alaskans typically outgive on average for many households across the state. But in fact, we have room to grow in that area. So indeed, nonprofits are responding to this shift in federal funding by generating more earned revenue. We are also, again, outpacing the average household in giving and philanthropy, especially in rural Alaska. But we are unsure if we can continue to make up for the losses in government funding at the same rate that they are declining. We also, other ways that we are working on this, organizations are creatively partnering with government, business, and other nonprofits. We hear that a lot. Why don't nonprofits collaborate more? And we have example after example about how that is happening and how we are working on community issues. And we also, we know that all of that work both takes money in and itself, but it also takes time to adapt. So we know that it takes time and it takes planning in order to continue to adapt to the shifting landscape that we operate in. Now, while some of this data is a little bit old, and we again getting you the new data as soon as we can, we have current data. So in the last 2 months, we have conducted a study of the current nonprofit sector in Alaska to capture what we are calling their mood, or how they're feeling about the issues that are facing them as at the federal, state, and local level. To be clear, this is a statistically relevant sample. This is a huge slide with too much information just to show you that we got a very good statistically relevant sample of urban and rural and different kinds of nonprofits. And we were also able to use this data to compare it to some data that we have conducted in 2016. So you'll see a little bit of comparison there as well. You are likely not surprised that overall nonprofit leaders are generally pessimistic about both the national landscape, and you'll see in a moment about our state landscape. And very interestingly, board members are more pessimistic than our CEOs. And why you should care about that, of course, is that there are more board members. Your average nonprofit has about 10 people on a board, and we're talking about 7,000 nonprofits in total, so you can do the math for that. And so we have more board members who are overly pessimistic or more pessimistic than the CEOs. And so there's more of them, but again, it's also important to recognize that they come from every sector of our economy. So they're coming from business and government and the nonprofit sector. And if they're more pessimistic, I think that's an area for all of us to be concerned about. Conversely, you might recognize that our nonprofit CEOs are used to weathering storms. They're used to working in fairly difficult situations, and most of them are highly adaptable. So not surprising that they are a little bit more on the optimistic side than our board members. When we ask them how they're feeling about the state, they are equally anxious, and overall worried certainly prevails across the sector. When we asked nonprofits if the fiscal gap was affecting their mission, their overwhelming answer was yes. And they pointed to funding as the piece that was creating the most anxiety for them. They certainly cited other issues, but by and large, funding was the biggest issue for them.
A question from Representative Grin.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Laura, could you when you say funding, is that not government funding, but maybe private funding?
So this particularly is about the fiscal gap in particular. So we have lots of verbatim answers from, and we've coded all of that. And over and over and over again, it is the lack of a fiscal plan that they cite as their cause for uncertainty. There's kind of general uncertainty or anxiety. That's kind of the smaller number there in the darker blue. But overwhelmingly, what they're saying is that this notion of how it is all going to play out for them is causing high anxiety. Yep. So when we
Oops, I'm sorry. Went too fast though. So I think it's important to recognize that they have, so our nonprofits have high anxiety about their federal funding is going down. They have anxiety about how the state funding is going, and we've already seen cuts from previous years. We anticipate more cuts coming. And so let's couple that with the understanding that nonprofits also have less unrestricted cash reserves available than they did compared to last year. So our nonprofits are tapping into their savings in order to cover the costs of late government payments, which occurred last year, increased costs, and loss of funding. Overall, nonprofits do expect their earned income to increase, and they do expect the government funds to decrease. And they have there is not a single answer for how they are dealing with philanthropy. Some are seeing increase, many are seeing decrease. Again, it all leads to this kind of time of uncertainty. And for their charitable giving, our nonprofits have to really ramp up their infrastructure in order to start to generate more charitable giving. And that is, as we all know, a very slow process.
Mr. Chairman?
Wilson?
Thank you. So particularly on this slide on Pick, Click, and Give, last year people didn't anticipate a cut in their PFD. So when they gave, it was based on a much larger PFD. Now, when they gave this year, with all the talk being between $1,000 and $1,250 primarily, although it could be anything until the process is done, have you received the numbers for Pick, Click, and Give yet, or at least what is the flavor out there now with people knowing that their PFD was going to be so much lower before they gave versus last year?
Through the chair, I don't have the Pick, Click, and Give numbers with me at the moment, but we certainly can get them for you. We know that they will change somewhat as the numbers kind of roll in and the PFD is decided. But we were actually pleasantly surprised that the overall numbers for Pick, Click, and Give did not drop to the level of uncertainty. Alaskans really stepped up and participated in supporting the philanthropic causes that they care about. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but we certainly can get them for you.
One other follow-up?
Follow-up?
And with the uncertainty that a lot of the nonprofits are thinking about, if the income tax does pass and you're allowed to use your permanent fund dividend to do that, how concerned are they that people will choose to utilize their permanent fund to pay their income tax and then have even less reserves to be able to go for their charity?
Through the chair, we have not studied that question. That is a new concept that we have not tested. We don't know how nonprofits would feel about that.
Mr. Chairman, if you find out, I think that would be really relevant to the discussion we had on Friday and then on how Pick, Click, and Give might or might not be able to survive with that being an option.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Wolf, I looked ahead a couple slides. Maybe I missed it, but do you have a way to measure overall nonprofit funding? I can see the cash reserves are lower for the more than 1 year mm-hmm. category, but can you say whether nonprofits have received less funding in recent years or whether it's going up or are those numbers you don't have?
So through the chair, I can say generally, right, there's no typical nonprofit, but generally we know government funding is down, both federal and state funding is down. That should come as no surprise in this room. And generally we can say that earned revenue is increasing, so organizations who are figuring out how to do mission-based earned revenue, which the IRS allows to be tax-exempt, And we are also seeing nonprofits grow in their individual philanthropy. It has been 4Acres' goal for the last 17 years, and this is one of those places where we partner heavily with the Rasmussen Foundation and the Community Foundation to help Alaskans figure out what the power of individual philanthropy is. And Pick, Click, Give was one of the initial efforts in that arena, and it has been wildly successful to help Alaskans understand the power of philanthropy. So Pick, Click, Give always had three goals: to grow the individual number of donors, to grow the amount people gave, but also to raise the awareness about the power of individual philanthropy in the state. And to that end, I think we have seen success, and we will continue to help organizations. 4Acres deeply committed to helping organizations figure out how to grow individual philanthropy, but that will not grow at a rate to make up the difference for state, the loss of state and federal funds. We can't, philanthropy cannot fill in that gap.
And just one other question, and again, if you don't have the answer, it's fine. It's only recent, I guess, but last year we lost, I guess, 7,600 jobs. My analysis is that's going to keep happening unless the state gets its act together. Is that showing up at all, the job losses at all? Is that showing up at all in the giving or the anxiousness that nonprofits have, or is it too early to tell?
I think it's, through the chair, I think it is too early to tell. I will say that when we've asked nonprofits what they expect to do in terms of their jobs, we are seeing nonprofits, the need is greater every day. As you all cut the budget more, you actually create more need in community, and the needs don't go away just because the money goes away. So our nonprofits are trying to figure out how to meet the need with the staff that they have. Some are able to shift some funds around and add some staff, but overall I think you'd see the same, you'll see the same cuts. I don't have that data in front of me, but it's a great question.
Thanks. Representative Grin.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Lori, we talked about individual giving perhaps going up in the last few years. Does Forker, do you guys track corporate giving for the state, if that's changed?
That's a, through the chair, that's a great question, and there is no single way to track that data. We have tried many times to get some good solid data, but corporations don't have to release that data. It's very hard to track. We've just begun to look at that. For the current, we have anecdotal information about the decline from the oil industry and other significant corporate donors, but we have no hard facts about that. We are beginning to look at that. Philanthropy Northwest, which is a regional grant-making organization that covers the Pacific Northwest and Alaska, have done some studies, but it's not a comprehensive look.
So with that, I guess, you mentioned also how nonprofits are collaborating and consolidating or shared services, and you had examples. Could you, even at the end, I guess, of the presentation, could you share some of those with us?
Yeah, through the chair, we see collaboration on a continuum, everything from, you know, let's work together and share some information on a limited one and done kind of project all the way through merger or even beyond that, organizations working better together, doing something, I like to say, 1 + 1 = 12, doing something better together than they could by themselves. In fact, they do that best when they're collaborating with government and the for-profit industry as well. We have examples in all of those continuums of organizations doing that work. In terms of finding ways to bring that economy of scale and kind of build the ecosystem to solve major problems, we have examples throughout our state of organizations working together, again, in a whole variety of ways, and I'm happy to provide examples as people have questions, or we can do regional examples, or there's so many examples. And, you know, I think it's one of the things that people kind of easily point at and say, boy, if there was just less nonprofits, this would be all better. But it's in the same breath, people say, well, if there were just more for-profits. So somehow it's that less nonprofits is good, but more for-profits is better. And that doesn't make any sense to us because we're all in it together, and we're actually quite effective and efficient at doing our work. So that play doesn't often work out so well. What we think is that if we're working better together, we'll actually solve our community problems.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. You have a slide earlier about the pessimism or the pessimistic attitude of boards and CEOs. You know, as the government does cuts on the state and national level, you're looking at stress on nonprofits, stress on the board, stress on the CEOs, stress on the staff and the clients. Have you been able to judge or manage that? Or, you know, when you get down to the bottom of that, or to the last thing I mentioned, the clients, you kind of come around to the childhood stress issues also. When you're putting that stress on families, all of a sudden the spiral of behavior becomes, you know, what are you creating? What, you know, you're not by intent, but by actions, you're creating the uptick in problems. Has that been a problem that's measurable?
Through the chair, I think we could go back to the report from Mr. Storrs and the Alaska Children's Trust to get your answer to that question. We certainly haven't done research about that, but we can tell you that we have ramped up at 4-Acre our efforts to build support mechanisms to create lots of peer support among CEOs, among development professionals, among CFOs, direct service providers. We're doing more and more support, cohort support and peer support, because we know that's the thing that's going to help people weather this, weather all of this anxiety. And again, as they're there to provide those services for people who are experiencing more stress, the stress level on them, they absorb a lot of that. So I can tell you we have ramped up our services to provide for the nonprofit employees and try to deal with their stress that way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, ma'am. So I appreciate this work, but I think there's other ways to approach the lack of amount of money that goes into the nonprofits. I don't think there's a nonprofit that I've spoken to that doesn't feel that the amount of regulations and paperwork that they have to deal with every day is a large part of their operating expenditures. I know when I chaired the S committee, we had some meetings up in Fairbanks, and I asked one of the largest nonprofits there what their operating expenditures were. There's up over 67%, where average industry is 23%. Mm-hmm. A lot of this has to do with the amount of extensive paperwork that we require under government accountability. With your extensive work with the nonprofits, is this a big topic of discussion amongst the nonprofits, the amount of extra bureaucracy and paperwork they have to do? There's a lot of money goes out there that they cannot use. They don't even apply for grants that are available because the amount of paperwork can amortize their investment. What discussions go on with those, and how can we get by with what we've got by using the tools that we have to reduce the amount of redundancy and amount of paperwork to get to the nonprofits? Is there a lot more money available that could be done if we had some regulation review?
So through the chair, I can't speak to the amount of money. I don't have research based on that, but I can certainly tell you that In 2015, when we started having these conversations about the economy and what we could do about it, we certainly saw lots of our coalitions come together and talk about where it was that they could work with government to reduce some of the regulations or requirements that were actually prohibiting them from doing more work or serving more people. And we have certainly encouraged them to work in partnership. So what I would say to your question is, you have to invite them to the table. you have to ask them, you have to ask those nonprofit leaders, what are the things that are stopping you from serving more people with less money? Where are the things that are costing you? Why aren't you applying for those funds? What is that red tape? If we don't bring them to the table and ask them and have them partner with you to get to that answer, we won't get to a good answer. I would also say that, you know, part of that is that we want collaboration, as mentioned earlier. We want collaboration, but we set up competition. So even in this environment, even the state funding environment, we create methods where we take two organizations who are doing work who could be amazingly collaborative and incredibly effective, and we make them compete for funding. And that's a whole process that doesn't make a whole bunch of sense to just about everyone. and it takes a bunch of time and energy and costs a lot of money instead of changing the way that we have the conversation. But I think I would strongly encourage you, if there are areas where you think that there is excessive red tape or excessive regulation, I would strongly encourage you to invite those nonprofit leaders to the table and not decide for them, but work with them to have those conversations, because I think they have a lot of really wonderful ideas about what could change.
Ms. Chair, so it sounds to me like your sense is also that a large percentage of their operating costs or what they have to put into goes to covering the bureaucracy amount of paperwork. And trying to cover that.
do you you don't have any sense of how much more of 20% more reductions in that?
Through the chair, I don't have that data. It's a wonderful question, and I think you would see it vary by subsector, right? The fisheries answer would be different than the healthcare answer, which would be different from the homelessness answer, which would, et cetera. So I think you have to decide where you see the opportunities and then invite those folks to the table. And if there are areas that are of specific interest, we certainly can help get those folks to the table to have those conversations with you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I may. Mr. Chair, last year I did approach the administration with the governor with Administrative Order 266, which was really done by Governor Parnell at the end of his term, which asked for regulation review and reform and to go back and look and to see how we can get better efficiencies through regulation reform. As the commissioners were coming through this year, maybe this is something you should look at. I hope you would, Mr. Chair. I asked the commissioners of how Administrative Order 266 was approached by them and if they had any regulations that they could tell me about that they worked on, and none of the commissioners knew what I was talking about. So it didn't go very far down the line. And again, when I get very frustrated when I talk to these nonprofits, and they tell me that there's money available, but they won't even go after the grants because of the amount of paperwork that they have to have. Yet we sit right here and say we need more money from government to give to them to help them cover the needs of people who need it, who need services. Yet right now we're only asking to add an income tax and use the permanent fund dividend to help cover these extra expenditures as opposed to regulation reform to use the money that we're already getting there. And that's very frustrating to me, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to continue on Representative Newman's line of reasoning, when nonprofits go out to grants, there are caps on the amount of money that can be used for administrative purposes. Is that a problem? I mean, you know, you're not going to go after grants if you can't, you know, if it requires paperwork, but there's a certain amount of it required in the job, but you can't pay for it, use that money to do that. You have to just give it to the clients or deliver the service to the client, but reporting and requirements in order to do graphs and have accountability built into it. Where is that break even? I mean, you're not going to go for a grant if it doesn't allow you to do what you need to do to measure and do the accountability work. So is that a problem on restrictions or the amount of grants that are available for administration? Or is there a balance missing in there someplace?
Through the chair, again, it's hard to make general statements, but what I would say overall is that certainly there is what is known commonly as the overhead myth, which is that nonprofits should be able to do fabulous, wonderful, quality work without actually paying any staff or time to do that work or have a desk or an office. And we see that to an extreme in some cases. Certainly for government funding, both at the state, federal, and local level, there is some percentage that is often given to overhead or administration, often known as an indirect rate. It is often far below what is required to do the work. And so nonprofits must offset that money with charitable dollars or their own reserves or earned revenue dollars. And so they need unrestricted cash, and they can only generate that really in two ways. Either they're going to earn it or they're going to raise it. And they have to use that to offset those unrealistic expectations about what overhead really costs. It's a national challenge, not just a Alaska challenge. But we certainly encourage all funders, private and government funders, to be realistic about what it really costs to do the work that they're asking to be done. We believe nonprofit employees should make a livable wage, and we believe they should be paid for the work that they do, and that gets fed right back into our economy, which is why we're here today.
Thank you. Representative Grin.
Thank you, Mr. Gochar. I think it was mostly answered. Laurie, what would you say to a nonprofit that had 50, 60, 70% of their revenue and their expenses was going out towards administrative costs. That doesn't sound normal, or not to speak in generalities again. But if their expenses were 50-67% was administrative costs, what would you work with them on?
I think through the chair, I think we have to know what the line of business is. It's too hard to answer a general question like that. Certainly, it creates more questions for me than answers.
Representative Gere.
Thank you. So right now, there are some proposals in this building for roughly $40 million worth of additional cuts to senior services, disability services, children's services, mental health services. And I've heard some comments that don't worry, the nonprofits will just step in and take care of it. Do us as nonprofits sort of have the ability to sort of step in and deal with the large kinds of budget cuts we're talking about here?
Through the chair, with what money would you like them to do that with?
That's a no.
Well, to speak in generalities, I think I've heard, you know, philanthropy will make up the difference. I think that's incredibly unrealistic. First of all, it takes a different kind of infrastructure in the organization to generate that kind of revenue. Most of our nonprofits who have had a long-time relationship with government funds and, in fact, are doing the work of government. But as you all know, the way our Constitution is written in Alaska, our nonprofits do the work that in other states government provides. But our nonprofits are doing that work on your behalf. And that's a partnership. That's an agreement that we have all entered into, and we happily do that work. But it's a relationship and it's a partnership, and we need to stick together here. So just expecting that you can cut that service, but you're still, as a state, we're still required to provide that service, frankly, is only going to be more expensive in the long run.
Want to go down this, but you got some questions about applying for grants and how much overhead that takes, and I've worked with nonprofits, and applying for grants is not easy, but that's true for both grants that are being issued by private companies and by the government. It's not like somebody has a monopoly on making grant writing difficult, is it?
Through the chair, I would argue, as a former development professional for 20 years of my life, that government funds are far more complicated to ask for and to manage than private philanthropy. So from personal experience, I would say government money is far, far more difficult. Both hold us equally accountable and equally transparent, and we're happy for that as a sector. We have strong code of ethics, strong accountability, but the level of reporting and red tape that is required by government is far different than getting a $500 grant from your local Rotary, for example.
Thanks. Fair enough. We'll talk to you afterwards to see if there's anything we can do.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Go back to page 10. If we look at the government grants in 2013, it's 34% of the funding revenue for nonprofits. What's the dollar value on those silos?
Let me just pull that up for you once. So on the 2013 numbers, so the on earned revenue it's $1.74 billion, on government grants it's $1.48 billion, and on contributions it's $330 million.
Mr. Chair, even at a 10% efficiencies, we're looking at another $148 million for nonprofits. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do we have any further questions of the committee? Please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. So no big surprise. We asked all of the issues facing our nonprofit leaders across the country, what is the highest area of concern that they would like to address? And they all turned their attention to Alaska, and then specifically they noted the state plan and budget as their primary area of concern.
I'd like to recognize we're joined in the audience by Representative Parrish.
So I will conclude and then happy to take more questions. So in closing, nonprofits want what all of the industries who have sat in front of you want. We want economic durability, predictability, and stability. Cutting the budget means cutting more of our sector, and that means spending more money in the long run. As nonprofits, we are on the ground, we are doing the work, and we are doing it in an effective and efficient as possible. And Alaskans are counting on us to continue to do that work. We know that the needs don't go away just because the funding is gone. It only makes it more expensive to do the work. The price of doing nothing is substantial. It would add to our already uncertain world. It all but guarantees further cuts to state services. It creates more demand for services with less ability to pay for them. It creates more pressure on the nonprofit sector to subsidize government, which again, we are already seeing this happening with delayed state payments and delayed contracts. It creates more pressure on city government, who in turn put the pressure on nonprofits and in their communities. And again, we're seeing that with issuing of new taxes that try to include the nonprofit sector. It creates more uncertainty to partner effectively in collaboration. It distracts nonprofit staff and board leaders from delivering mission because they must currently adapt and adjust to this economic uncertainty. So we are asking for a long-term fiscal plan so we can plan, not just react. We have heard loud and clear from our nonprofit sector that fiscal stability is critically important in delivering essential services across the state. Since 2015, 4-Acre has been calling for a long-term fiscal plan. That is not new. We would like that plan to be complete, that promotes rural and our urban communities alike and protects Alaska's most vulnerable populations, education, and cultural life. We would like a plan that recognizes the value of the nonprofit sector and the role it plays in streamlining services, saving resources, and impacting change. We would like a plan that does not depend on a single sector, ours, to sustain it, and that is determined based on fairness, equity, and ability to pay. We believe that nonprofits provide valuable resources within our community, and we are a part of the economic solution. Additional substantial cuts only create long-term fiscal financial challenges for the people of Alaska. And so in closing, I would offer that we stand with you, with government, as part of the solution to ensuring a vibrant and healthy communities across our state. I am happy to answer more questions, but that is the end of my presentation.
Well, good. Thank you. We've got a question from Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. And something that you said earlier is something that I agree with you, that our relationship is a partner. You're doing the work that many states and jurisdictions, the states do them themselves. You know, your comments about the state having a plan, I think the reference here is, you know, a fiscal plan that stabilizes the state. But aside from that, you are in a significant vantage point in the state looking at all the nonprofits. Does the state have a comprehensive plan, besides that, a comprehensive plan that looks at the needs of the state and how it gives out its grants that deals with those things in some way that is not just efficient, but delivers the services where it needs to go, how it needs to be done? Is there a giant overview of some organization, some part of the state government that does that, and maybe we don't, maybe we should?
Through the chair, if that exists, I don't know about it. I don't actually know of any state that has that answer. It would be an interesting research project and something to look for.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, and first of all, thank you for bringing up the competition part. I was part of a nonprofit for a long time, and I know Fairbanks was trying to change the being collaborative versus, you know, always trying to one up, because that's what the funding did. It was because of that. But the question I have, though, I just want to kind of make a distinction between, you know, cuts that are made into the budget versus the restructuring of programs. For instance, SB 74 a couple years ago, looking at Medicaid and how better to streamline what was going on and the decreases that would come because of that. So do you think some of our time would be better spent looking at those larger programs? I mean, healthcare is something we look at all the time, of cost of procedures here versus Seattle or somewhere else, the insurance that we are seeing that doesn't just affect state government, but if you have any employees that have health care, I mean, there are ways to save money in not just government but other places that we probably do have our hands in. Would you see those type of priorities going into that being different than just looking at the numbers in the budget itself?
Through the chair, I think that's a really healthy line of reasoning. And what I would say is you have experts on the ground doing that work every single day. And if that was the path forward or a path forward, I can't strongly encourage you enough to do that with the nonprofit sector, not at them, not for them, but with them, because they are the experts on the ground. They know this work inside and out. They know what regulations are helpful and what keeps people safe and what keeps us accountable. And they know which ones are maybe were from a time long ago and still exist. So if that's the path that you choose to take, just take it with us. Go with our sector. Invite us to the table. Engage us in conversation before any decisions are made, because you have experts on the ground in every field you can imagine.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
It seems like we might be spending extra time here. Maybe it'd be a good time to have them at the table, because there are so many issues we have in the state that doesn't just impact our budget, that where we could save on the budget of the state, but would also save money for the nonprofits and businesses alike. So maybe after we get done talking about extra taxes, maybe that would be something we could do next week. Thank you.
Thank you. And I would like to just make sure that everybody realizes that when we're talking about cost savings that we've made in SB 74 and all, we can't count those costs before we reform the system and before we made the changes to get the cost, because it costs money to do those reforming. And it's the same thing, I believe, with the nonprofit sector. When we want them to change the way they do business, to go through large remodeling of their procedures, that isn't done ad hoc and just on a whim, and all of a sudden you have savings because you've changed something. It's a structural change that costs money to implement, and we found that in state government as well. Often we are counting our chickens before the eggs hatch, because we say, oh, here's a recommendation and that'll save us money. But we haven't done it yet. We haven't spent the money to get the information. So I did have a question for you, and that was the increasing reliance on earned income. How much diversion of your nonprofits that we're talking about, how much diversion from their main mission and to go into earned income? How does that affect both the looking at administrative costs, and how does that affect the nonprofits as far as becoming a totally different entity, having a business, trying to run a business instead of trying to provide services?
So through the chair, before I answer that question, let me just echo that the myth of merger is that it saves money. In fact, every merger, we facilitate many mergers, and they're all expensive, not because of us, but because any reorganization costs a lot of money. And so I couldn't agree with your comments more earlier that it's not a magic bullet. It's a journey. It often takes many years for organizations to redesign or reconstruct in a way
that might be in the long term more effective. To your question around earned revenue, what I would say is we're talking about is mission-related revenue, and so nonprofit is a tax structure, not a business model. So nonprofit, so a not-for-profit organization can absolutely generate its revenue. Foraker is an example of that. We generate about 80% of our revenue by doing the mission work. So when we talk about mission-based earned revenue, we are talking about organizations doing their mission and figuring out how to have some sort of financial exchange for that. Maybe it's a third-party payer, like in a healthcare situation where it's an insurance provider, or Medicaid or Medicare, or maybe it's a mission-based consulting, or maybe it's contract work where, again, the contract is with state government or the federal government to deliver the service. So we would consider all of those strategies earned revenue strategies. Those are not distractions from mission. Those are the nonprofit doing mission. They have just figured out how to do it in a way that has an exchange, a financial exchange. Now, it'll never be at 100%. You'll never see a not-for-profit organization have 100% earned revenue, because one of the things that makes us not-for-profits is that we're non-viable in the marketplace. There is no one-for-one exchange, and so we're often below market, or there's some piece, often an educational component of our mission, that is not, you can't sell that, you can't monetize that. It is a greater good component. So I don't want to be misleading when we talk about earned revenue. We are talking about organizations doing their mission and figuring out how to have a financial exchange for that. And that is just different than the way that we would generate philanthropic dollars. It takes a different board requirement, different infrastructure requirement, different staff knowledge. And so most of our nonprofits have a strength. Either they're strong in generating their earned revenue and they kind of dabble in the charitable, or they're really strong in the charitable and they dabble in the earned. But almost every nonprofit has some combination of those strategies in their budget, because that's how they get to a balanced budget. They too need a comprehensive plan, right? They too need a diversified revenue.
Representative Wilson?
Thank you. And I just want to clarify one thing. I wasn't asking the nonprofits to change the way they're doing things. I'm talking about government. And to Representative Seaton, if something happened in SB 74 or any others with anticipation of savings and it's not happening, I think that would be something, again, sometimes it's good to review programs that have been put in place and making sure that they did what we anticipated that they do. And if not, why not, and what do we need to do? But I'm not talking about the nonprofits and doing anything to them.
Okay, any further questions of the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much, Ms. Wolf.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, next up we have Natasha Singh from the Tenant Chiefs Conference, and also Grace Singh from the Central Tlingit, Council of Tlingit and Haida. And so if you could both come up and put yourselves on the record, your name and your affiliation. Since we have two female voices, if you could just say your name for transcription whenever you speak. And glad to have you here. Grace used to work in my office years ago, so welcome back. And so with that, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for this opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Natasha Singh, General Counsel of Tenana Chiefs Conference. I offer greetings from our CEO and Chief, Victor Joseph, who regrets he cannot be here today.
And for the record, my name is Grace Singh, Government Affairs Liaison for Central Council, Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. I also offer greetings from our President Richard Peterson. Both President Peterson and Chief Joseph are attending the Governor's Tribal Advisory Council, which was scheduled before this generous invitation. Also, we might as well get the first question out of the way. Yes, we are sisters. Yes, she's the older one. We grew up in Fairbanks, the North Pole, where Stevens Village Tribal members, but as I said, now I live in Juneau.
Thank you, Grace. Well, Tanana Chiefs was not officially incorporated until 1962, or formed in 1962. Our organization actually dates back over 100 years, when the Interior Chiefs came together, united to protect Native land claims, an issue that continues on today. Tanana Chiefs Conference is a consortium of 42 interior communities, 37 of which are federally recognized tribes. We provide a variety of services, from land surveying to dental health, tribal court support to prevention services. We provide these services in an area of 235,000 square miles, or about 37% of this entire state. TCC serves more than 16,000 Alaska Natives and an additional 5,000 non-Native residents. TCC and other tribes and tribal nonprofits have the authority under federal law to provide health, behavioral health, workforce development, and tribal government support through federal contracts and grants. Also, through specific statutes and agreements with the state, TCC provides state services, which we will highlight a few of those in a few minutes.
And Mr. Chair, for the record, this is Grace speaking. Central Council Klinkin Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska was formed in 1935 to pursue a Native Land Claims Act. The organization evolved out of the desire to retain traditional way of life through the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood. Klinkin Haida is unique among the state's regional nonprofits because we are a federally recognized regional tribe, serving more than 30,000 tribal citizens. Several of our peer nonprofits across the state represent tribal consortiums, the largest of which being TCC with 37 federally recognized tribes. These nonprofit organizations provide services to rural Alaska on behalf of the state and federal governments. These combated services significantly saves the state and government agencies money, as tribal governments have the networks and infrastructure in rural Alaska required to administer these programs. Contrary to popular belief, these nonprofit service providers are not 100% funded by the federal and state agencies. The programs are often significantly underfunded, and to provide quality services and employees, tribes like Klinkit and Haida compensate more than $1 million a year of tribal money for these programs that benefit Natives and non-Natives in rural Alaska. In addition to being a standalone organization, Central Council contributes to a partnership of five regional nonprofits known as the Alaska Regional Coalition. The five nonprofits include Klinkit and Haida here in Southeast, Tanana Chiefs Conference in Fairbanks in the Interior Region, Manilik in the Northwest Region, Kuwerik in the Bering Straits Region, and Chugiachimute in the Prince William Sound Region. Just us five coalition members, we bring in approximately $250 million in federal money annually for the state of Alaska. And while we're not here today to speak for the other regional nonprofits outside of our coalition, we would like to point out that together, the state's Native nonprofits, whether they be tribal authorities, housing authorities, or health or justice organizations, the overall economic impact of our organizations runs into the multiple billions of new money to the state annually.
Mr. Chairman, again, this is Natasha Singh speaking. Today's topic, Alaska's economy and fiscal policy, is a welcome conversation because the state's Native regional nonprofits, we have a significant role in delivering essential services to Alaskans, and not just to tribal members. It's important to note here on the record, we provide services to everyone in our communities, not just Alaska Natives. It's a myth that our services are limited to one Alaskan and not another. And this is a good time as any to address another misconception about Alaska Natives wanting an income tax because we wouldn't have to pay for it. This is not the case. Our regional corporations, our development companies, and our regional nonprofits generate billions of dollars of revenue in this state. not to mention the thousands upon thousands of Alaska Natives who live and work in our state, or the thousands of high-paying jobs these entities create for non-Natives who enjoy the benefit of working for our numerous enterprises. Our staff, our headquarters, are often located in the state's major population centers, and we generate robust revenue for municipalities and the state through our economic activity. We often hear that we want an income tax because we wouldn't pay for it. That's simply not the case. We want an income tax because that's what's best for Alaska. We are part of this state, and we contribute far more to the economy than we are credited for in discussions about fiscal policy. That said, Tanana Chiefs Conference, therefore, has numerous critically important intersections with the state budget, primarily with the State Department of Health and Social Services, but also with the Department of Public Safety, as we provide public safety services through the VPSO program in remote rural Alaska, with the Department of Law, where we partner with the state of Alaska to deliver judicial services that keep the people accountable in their own rural villages. We work with the Department of Labor for voc ed and job training, with the Department of Education and Early Development, where we provide Head Start programs. And it should be noted, we provide these contract services at a savings to the state. Now we would like to provide specific examples of types of essential services that the state, through constitutional or statutory obligation, are provided by TCC through contract. I am very proud that our state, through TCC, is committed to supporting our elders. The senior community-based grants are specifically designed to help elders maintain independence and remain in their own homes and communities. We have an elder in Nenana, Claude, who is able to live at home, which saves the state money, but also is a place where he wants to be. Through this important grant, he is able to remain at home, teaching the younger generations all of his knowledge, and the younger generations are able to care for him in his home. I believe he's online. Hello, Grandpa Claude. In addition to elder services, the state, through TCC, provides a variety of programs for the disabled, children with complex medical conditions, Alaskans with traumatic brain injuries, Alzheimer's disease, and related disorders. We provide programs and services to improve the quality of life for people who are impacted by mental disorders or illnesses, really the most vulnerable Alaskans.
For the record, this is Grace. And similarly, Tlingit and Haida and other regional nonprofits also administer programs on behalf of the Department of Social Services and provide multiple federal, state, and tribal programs to ensure the needs of our tribal children are met. When families have a child protective case, Tlingit and Haida and other regional nonprofits are able to refer and provide necessary services and programs to establish self-sufficiency, provide employment and training opportunities, and ultimately keep families intact for the most vulnerable of our people. These programs include women, infants, and children, child care services, temporary assistance for needy families, and general assistance. We use these programs as a one-stop shop service, leveraging federal programs to address the needs of all of our tribal citizens. As the Alaska Children's Trust testified, these services are an investment in Alaska's future. Addressing these socioeconomic issues effectively and early saves the tribe, the state, and the federal government money in the future.
While TCC funding is mostly through federal contractors, interior Alaskans rely heavily on the state funding for behavioral health and substance abuse treatment. Unfortunately, as opioids and meth become epidemic across our state and nation, more and more Alaskan families are in need of these vital services that either prevent substance abuse or treat substance abuse. The state, through TCC, provides help to individuals at the onset of a behavioral health crisis or psychiatric emergency, recognizing, even at the earliest stages of intervention, that the goal is always to maintain the individual in the least restrictive and clinically appropriate location. We recently received this kind of funding through a grant for TOC, a predominantly non-Native community, in which the entire program was at maximum capacity before the doors opened. TCC, on its own, is supplementing the grant so we do not turn anyone away in TOC. Alaska cannot afford to have less of these services given the increased rates of drug use. We need more.
Given what Natasha said about the current epidemic of drug use, it is more critical today to improve the rural public safety. Through contract with the Department of Public Safety, we regional nonprofits provide the Village Public Safety Officer Program. The VPSOs preserve public peace, protect life and property, and provide public safety for Alaskan citizens, both Native and non-Native, in rural communities. The VPSO officers are often the first responders to violent or emergency situations. This is an example of something that causes us some concern. The Senate version of the operating budget recommends a decrease of $200,000 to fund an Alaska State Trooper position. While we support efforts to increase public safety presence in Alaska, we don't want it done at the expense of rural Alaskan communities. In fact, the fund targets for reallocation are currently being used to support the VPSO program. These funds are primarily reserved for positions, but when there are vacancies, those funds can and are being used to address recruitment and retention efforts, including unfunded mandates such as holding cells and offices. We hope the conference committee supports the House version lines 7 and 13 on the DPS motion sheet. However, if the Senate version is adopted, we would like to ask the VPSO contractors be invited to participate in the preparation of the DPS report to the Senate about the efforts to improve recruitment and retention. And to be clear, Tlingit and Haida and the Alaska Regional Coalition supports every effort to increase public safety services throughout the state. And we encourage the House and Senate to provide a complete fiscal solution in order to provide these very necessary services. So with the understanding of the extensive work provided for the state of Alaska by our regional nonprofits, I would like to ask you to consider what's at stake here. If the state cuts funds to these programs or selects a fiscal plan that relies on multiple years of continued cuts without a complete plan in place to preserve these essential services, we recognize that the cuts identified by the legislature and governor over the past 3 years was necessary. But we also believe those cuts have gone far enough. We believe that additional cuts jeopardizes the constitutional and statutory obligations to provide public safety and health and social services to all Alaskans, regardless of their socioeconomic status or where they reside. The Executive Council of Central Council Tlingit and Haida has contemplated that question this spring and passed a resolution reaffirming our support for a complete fiscal plan that includes a progressive, broad-based revenue measure to balance the regressivity of cuts to state spending and a cap on the dividend. The Central Council resolution reads, in part, the Executive Council supports a multifaceted tax structure that wholly addresses Alaska's fiscal crisis and opposes a tax structure that burdens rural Alaskan residents and communities.
And the Tanana Chiefs Conference, also rightly concerned about the state's ability to provide essential services over time, passed a resolution both in 2015 and this spring that echoes Tlingit and Haida's resolution, but also comes out explicitly in favor of a certain revenue. The resolution reads, Tanana Chiefs Conference supports the most vulnerable, including children, the elderly, single parents, and low-income Alaskans, and opposes any state of Alaska deficit solution that would disproportionately impact these vulnerable groups. And the Tanana Chiefs Conference supports legislation that introduces an income tax. The members of the Regional Coalition Native, the Alaska Regional Coalition of Native Nonprofits are at various stages of explicit support of an income tax. TCC, Manilik, and the Alaska Federation of Natives all support an income tax. But what we have all in common is that we believe a complete plan is necessary and that a progressive element is necessary to balance the regressive elements of a cut and cap plan.
In closing, we'd just like to reiterate that our organizations are partners with the state of Alaska in delivering essential state services. We are on the front lines for behavioral health, senior benefits, public safety, and more within our 100 rural communities. And we love and care for our residents, just as we believe you do too. It may come as no surprise to you that we support a progressive revenue element to balance the regressive nature of budget cuts and a dividend cap, that we support a long-term solution over ones that leave it to chance whether the state can balance its budget, and whatever plan that the legislature agrees to is equitable across urban and rural Alaska.
We hope we've dispelled some myths today about the contributions that our beneficiaries make in terms of paying our share of cost to providing state services. We are willing to accept a cut to the permanent fund. Restructure and a dividend cap are reasonable steps that this state probably must take. But we urge you to consider the ethical and moral obligation we all have to one another to balance those elements with a progressive revenue measure to avoid disproportionately impacting one Alaskan over another. We are all in this together, and we are proud to do our part to stabilize the state economy and support a complete fiscal plan. With that, Chairman, we are available for questions. And again, thank you for this incredible opportunity to come speak with you today.
Thank you, Ms. Singh and Ms. Singh. Do we have any questions from the committee? Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I'll just say Grace and Natasha. But number one, you made a point earlier, and I would also apologize for any comment that anybody's made that somehow one region of the state would benefit over another region of the state from an income tax or any revenue measure. In the views, I think, of the other members of this committee, I think we represent the whole state, and divisions like that are really uncalled for. I also want to thank you for coming because for this reason. I mean, you today came here and you provided a voice for people that we don't hear from that much. We don't hear from those representing seniors because they really don't have a lobbyist, or those representing kids, or those representing the various people who don't get the voice in this legislature. So I appreciate that. I've heard from optometrists and ophthalmologists and oil company executives and many, many other professions, but today you came here to provide a voice for people who don't usually have a voice in the legislature as loud as the ones that we hear from others. So I want to thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have any further questions of the committee? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming today. I'm confused because I'm sitting here in my mind trying to come to a conclusion, and I can't come to an answer. So I'll ask you this. You've continually and repeatedly said that you will not support any revenue measures that disproportionately affect the population of Alaska. We know that the use of the permanent fund dividend is the most extreme revenue measures when it comes to disproportionately affecting lower income. I would expect that probably most people in rural Alaska, probably a lot of members of TCC, fall into that lower income group just because of the jobs that are not available. How can TCC and other organizations all-in, you know, support somewhat of an all-in approach to using the permanent fund dividend to reduce reductions and, you know, to reduce this deficit, yet that does disproportionately affect the majority of Alaskans at the same time.
Through the chair.
Natasha Singh.
Thank you. That is an excellent question, and I completely agree. A reduction and restructure of the permanent fund alone would disproportionately impact our beneficiaries and our tribal members unfairly. But a complete plan, a plan that also requires others to contribute just as equally, addresses just that. We absolutely would not support a restructure of the permanent fund if that's the only solution that's put on the table. Thank you.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And ma'am, sir, both of you again. The last presenter I asked about regulation reform and the ability to do that or inability to do that and how much money is spent by the nonprofits trying to conform to state regulations and all the state employees that have to do all those regulations and oversee all that. Tremendous amount of effort and work by the nonprofits. You're directly involved in all that, right at the front lines. I don't know how to ask this question, but is there a percentage, or could you give us some indication as to how much you feel extra paperwork you have to do, which is money, accounts to money, that you cannot use for your people that you work for? Do you think we could reduce it by 20%, 30%, 40% of how much you actually need to make sure we have adequate accountability for those funds?
Through the chair. Thank you. Thank you for that question again, Representative Newman. I really appreciated the question to the earlier witness as well. So for tribal consortiums and tribal nonprofits, a large percentage of our contracts are federal contracts, and they come through federal statute, the Indian Self-Determined Education Assistance Act. This authority allows us to compact a number of programs through the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Interior. And through the federal regulations, we see what we call compacts that allows us to really piece together different programs, and also reporting back is done under one umbrella. That is a more efficient system that we're used to dealing with, and that I would love to come back and or take some time later one-on-one to educate you more on this system that the state probably should adopt. I don't know if it's measurable at this time to say we can reduce 20-30%, but I do agree we can reduce our reporting significantly. We are working with Commissioner Davidson directly on this issue right now. I know Grace is working with other commissioners to address this issue. So I agree it's an issue, and there are solutions out there, and there's models we're willing to share.
Mr. Chair, again, this is for the nonprofits that help Alaska with a lot of the social programs that we have out there. But I continue to hear this from all aspects of every industry within the state of Alaska. And those are jobs that all Alaskans can be using and taking advantage of. And, again, we have not heard anything about regulation reform from any of these organizations. So please help spread the word that that's what we need to be doing to the legislatures and the administration. I would certainly appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We've got a question from Representative Wilson and then Seaton.
Mr. Chairman, so the oil tax reform is also part of this package on it. And we've heard from NANA and from Barrow and some other organizations on the detriment that they felt that it could cause their areas, those that work in those jobs. And I'm not sure, you know, which groups are all part of your organizations, but have you heard that same concern from your organizations as far as jobs are being lost on the slope currently because of oil prices, and that could also be because of this new tax regime that we're discussing?
Well, through the chair, specifically on oil tax reform. Tenant and Chiefs Conference and the Alaska Regional Coalition has not taken a position. I think we support specifically what we've talked about, a complete plan. We haven't taken a position on that.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
And it is part of the complete plan that's being discussed. Here's why I'm bringing it up. And I'm more concerned not necessarily whether you support it or not, but the same concerns that we heard from NANA, the same thing that we heard from the city of Barrows through some letters on, you know, the job losses they've already seen, the further job loss they think they'll see underneath the discussion on the House portion of it. And I was just more from others of your tribes that may be working in some of those sectors. And I know Fairbanks has a lot of jobs in their private sector that have to do with the oil fields. Are you hearing the same type of concern that the possible loss of good jobs, you know, happening to those that you represent?
And if I can answer through the chair, I'd like to bring up Representative Newman's question earlier about the capping of the permanent fund dividend. When Central Council here in Juneau was discussing the burden it will have on rural residents, the restructure of the tax credits was part of our resolution. We do support the restructure because we don't want our possibility of an income tax to go straight back as credits to the oil companies.
Through the chair, if I can follow up on Grace's answer.
Ms. Natasha Singh.
Representative Wilson, we're absolutely concerned about job losses in Alaska, specific across all sectors.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
And I'm not talking about the tax credits. I'm talking actual job losses in those areas. Last time we did one, Fairbanks was a big loser when we didn't get it right through ACES, and so that's that concern. The other question I have is kind of have the same issue that I brought up earlier, you know, with those communities that have a sales tax or those communities that have higher costs of energy or food or all the others. As you were making the resolution to supporting an income tax to offset the permit fund, do you hear from all those communities as part of that? Because I can't imagine it's one size, you know, fits all, just because Fairbanks, although we pay more for energy, it's nothing compared to if I was, you know, further out into another area. Property taxes are in some of your areas, or not in some of the others. So did you have I guess my question really is, did you have the full discussion, not just whether or not this tax or that tax or the cut in the permit fund, but the overall impact it would have to their expendable cash, how it might affect their financial burden they already have, raising children in the areas and being able to stay there? Can they really take any more stress of anything else coming off of their income? Kind of the whole picture versus just one.
Ms. Natasha Singh.
Through the chair. Thank you for that question. Yes, I believe our leadership from the 42 communities of Tanana Chiefs Conference had everything at the table. They did a lot of studying before they took this position. They didn't blindly take this position. And to get a group of 42 Native leaders to agree to an income tax wasn't taken lightly. So I believe they did their homework and they had their information in front of them. And the concerns you did bring up about all everything added up. What's the breaking point there? That was part of the discussion, and I believe our people just recognize the need for everyone contributing to the state. These are essential services. These are services provided to the most vulnerable.
And just finally.
Follow up.
I didn't think you took it lightly. I can only imagine what the discussion. But any concerns that they brought up of the other part of it, some of the negativity, although maybe the positive outweighed the negative that you would be able to share with us, would be very helpful, as we'd already heard in the past that some of the communities were having a hard time because the economics aren't there and it may not be there for a while. And maybe if you just saw one area having more problems than the other, although maybe generally everybody agreed, but any concerns that we should continue to look at, I'd appreciate. Thank you.
Got a question from Representative Seaton and then Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to thank you from TCC and Central Council and ANTHC and other, you know, great services that you provide that the state has not been able to. So, but not only that, it's not just the service, but the innovations with dental hygienists and the community medical clinics and the other para medical professionals that have been, you know, a demonstration to us of a better way to do things in much of Alaska and to get services that are locally available have been very important. And, you know, just one of the things that was brought up about income tax not being paid, I just wanted to, by rural Alaska, I just wanted to say that the ICER study that we have on effects of Alaska and fiscal options on children and families, you know, it breaks that down on page 7 that 16% of rural Alaskans are in the upper quartile. So they would definitely be in that range, as well as 19% in the second quartile, 50% and above. So the idea that rural Alaska is poor and doesn't have people who would be paying income taxes, I think that hopefully the research that's come forward here dispels that and also makes even more applicable your decisions to support progressive as well, paired with progressive elements to get a balanced plan. So I appreciate you coming forward today. Thanks.
Representative Newman and then Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just going back just to trying to get some clarification in my own mind. So we've heard it stated that we want to make sure that all Alaskans are treated equitable. And if you use a permanent fund dividend, a PFD, and say you take $1,000 out of that, whatever is determined by the legislature as a whole, all Alaskans will get that. Well, almost all Alaskans, probably 95-97% of Alaskans who apply for a permanent fund dividend will have $1,000 removed from their total income. But you don't support a plan unless people who make maybe more or in a higher income bracket are paying more above beyond just that permanent fund dividend. How do we consider that equitable? When I know that you can look at it as a percentage of their income, but all people are paying a certain amount, the same amount out of their permanent fund dividend, but yet some people are going to be asked to pay more.
Ms. Natasha Singh.
Thank you. Through the chair. Thank you for that question. I think we're going off the premise that Alaskans are in, are different. They're, whether they be elders, those that suffer from mental illness, those that are suffering from substance abuse. The dollar is different to different Alaskans. The dollar means something to me and something else to Grace. And we must recognize that as we look to solutions to this crisis, that while you can put it in simplistic terms that it could be viewed as fair if everyone contributes to the reduction of through the reduction of their permanent fund, but as the economic reports, whether it be Northern Economics or ICER, conclude that the dollar isn't the same to one Alaskan over another.
Representative Newman.
Yeah, thank you for allowing me a little leeway on this, Mr. Chair. I think this is an interesting discussion that many of us Alaskans are still having amongst each other. So I do appreciate a little bit of leeway on this. And your feedback on this also. So when I look at this too with the permanent fund dividend and the use of that, most Alaskans are going to be able to probably absorb a little bit of that. But yet when we look at I'm trying to get to the point that we're only going after one revenue stream. Do you feel that if the legislature passed a permanent fund dividend, but yet people in my district, I think primarily the Mat-Su region, so several legislators' districts adamantly oppose other revenue measures, even a permanent fund dividend. Yet the legislature probably will pass a permanent fund dividend, yet the people in my district, I know by probably 75-80%, do not want an income tax and other those other revenue streams like that. Do you recognize the fact that we do have differences? And I said there's not a day goes by when I don't say our differences is our strength. Do you recognize and realize it? Would you say then they should not do a, say, Senate Bill 26 or a permanent fund dividend bill if that's the only bill that's passed this year, because legislators like me or maybe Representative Tilton or others, Representative Wilson or Thompson or anybody here, the people in the district just adamantly oppose this. And if they don't get all those mayor revenue measures passed this year, you're willing to say don't do anything at all?
Through the chair. He's gazing out the window. I'm not familiar specifically with the bill numbers that you're referencing. I think just like the discussion that I recalled for Representative Wilson, and just like the discussions you hear probably every day in testimony, it is such a difficult it's such a difficult problem, and the solutions are even more difficult to get to. And as our leaders contemplated to support a complete fiscal package that also included a restructure of the permanent fund, that was very difficult. I think the word that comes to mind is compromise. Another word, just a long-term vision for our state, where Alaskans can rely on you all as leaders to lay out a plan where we can feel secure in our economy to continue in our missions, whether it be in the private or nonprofit sectors. I don't claim that all of this is intuitive. It doesn't, you know, talking to the everyday Alaskan who isn't engaged in these discussions, it's like, oh, yeah, sure, I'm paying income tax and take away my permanent fund. That isn't intuitive. But when you put everything on the table about education for children, providing a safety net so the most vulnerable don't cost us in the long run if we don't have those safety net services, when you get to those deeper and more, you know, complex situations, I think then you get there. We have to have a complete plan passed this year. I mean, I don't know. It's hard.
Okay, we've got a question from Representative Guttenberg and then Gara.
It's more an observation for Grace and Natasha, for Tlingit Haida and TCC. We welcome you here. I certainly wish you were at the table as often as you want to be and come often, because your voice is important. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thanks. So I already, the questions, I guess, are not really, I mean, you've been pretty clear about what your views are, and I appreciate it. When I was younger, there used to be like two sides of a Chinese menu, and one was called column A and one was called column B, and you had to choose between like all the stuff on column A and all the stuff on column B. And there are 30 different ways to address our fiscal plan, but one of the versions is less education funding and a $1,000 dividend and less university funding and less children's funding and less seniors funding, and one includes an income tax, fourth smallest in the country, some permanent fund restructure and some other measures, but doesn't have those cuts. And I guess between those column A, I mean, I think you were pretty clear, but if those were column A and column B, not to say we can't come up with other options, I take it you'd rather not see the continued cuts. Is that fair to say?
That's fair. Through the chair, that's fair.
Thanks.
Any further questions of the committee? I guess I just want to mention two things. On the question of equity, I'm sure you haven't seen this. This just came out yesterday, but Carl Davis with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy yesterday provided a presentation, and I guess the question comes up, how do you reconcile the fact that, you know, everybody's getting $1,000 taken from their dividend, and at the same time, an income tax would be a take on somebody who's, you know, making earning money versus somebody who's not, maybe. And so I guess the question is, how is that fair? And I'd like to share this with you, and maybe after finance we can get you a copy of this. But what was presented yesterday by Carl Davis was, it said that for somebody who is getting their permanent fund reduced by $1,000, folks in the lowest 20%, that share of their income, that 7.2% of their income, so it's regressive, because somebody who's in the top 20%, that's about 1.6% of their dividend. And so it's essentially, it's a regressive tax, and that's what you spoke to earlier. And then you move over to a personal income tax, and it shows the reverse. You know, it shows somebody who's not earning very much wouldn't be paying very much. They, if they're not earning anything or less than, say, you know, $15,000, then you might not be paying any income tax. And then folks in the top 20% would be paying just over 1% towards the state income tax. And so I guess the question of when that comes up, the question of equity, how is that fair? I think it's fair because exactly what you said, which is, you can't just do one or the other. You have to do both, because by doing both, folks who at the lower spectrum of the income scale are contributing according to a percentage of their income, not an absolute amount, but based on a percentage, versus somebody who's making more money. And so I would love to share this report with you afterwards, and so I think you hit it on the head, and I just kind of wanted to back that up with statistics. And then the other thing I wanted to say was, I wanted to echo what Representative Guerra said, and that is, you know, you're sharing a voice that's not shared very often down here in Juneau. It's expensive to fly in anywhere, from anywhere to Juneau, when you're flying here in Alaska. Whether you're coming from Anchorage or Fairbanks or Kenai or Wasilla, it's not cheap. But you represent places like Angoon, Stevens Village, New Lotto, Caltag. It's really expensive to come down here. And so I also want to echo what Representative Guerra said, and that is that you're helping to bring a voice and share a voice to folks from places in the state that, you know, normally cannot get down here and aren't able to share their voices, and folks who are most vulnerable and are low income folks who just, they can't afford lobbyists. So again, I just want to also echo what Representative Guerra said, and thank you very much. So with that, I don't think we have any other questions, and thank you.
Thank you so much.
So with that, we are going to move straight to our last order of business here, and that is an introduction of SB 107, which is the Alaska Capital Income Fund Bill. That's by the Senate Finance Committee. And at this time, I'd like to call Senator Anna McKinnon to the table, and her aide, Laura Kramer, is also welcome to join if she'd like. No? Okay. And so with that, Senator McKinnon, if you could put yourself on the record and proceed with introducing Senate Bill 107.
Good afternoon, co-chairs of House Finance and House Finance members. I'm Anna McKinnon, senator from Eagle River, Chugiak, and the bases. Before you today is a Senate Bill 107, an act relating to the Alaska Capital Income Fund. As you may already know, the state maintains 2,200 buildings within 14 agencies, including the University of Alaska and the court system. These facilities total 19 million square feet with a combined value of $8.6 billion. Currently, our deferred maintenance backlog is $1.84 billion. For the past 3 years, we've appropriated very little, so nothing, on deferred maintenance. This legislation proposes to create a funding stream to help the state of Alaska maintain our assets and extend the life and usefulness of those assets. Quite simply, this bill prioritizes deferred maintenance and is a suggestion, not binding, to any future legislative bodies. It is an income stream produced from the Amaretta Hess Fund, and it cannot be used to increase dividends to the people of Alaska. With that, it's a one-page bill.
Thank you. We've got two questions, Representative Kawasaki and then Thompson.
Thank you. Thank you for being here, Senator. Just a couple questions, because I know there are other special funds within the general fund. This is being one of them. The original language shows for any public purpose, and so we've been able to use the capital income fund for other capital projects, and over the last several years we've come to use it frequently. If you're putting language in here like this, doesn't that restrict it to the deferred maintenance and preventative maintenance only to current state facilities?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I wish it would. Think Alaska Performance Scholarship. That fund started out at over $450 million. This year it's at $349 million and proposed to be, by the budget proposed from the governor, $249 million. The legislature, through its financial process, cannot bind a future legislature. This is a recommendation that we extend the value and the life of the buildings that we own, 2,200 of them, to provide a revenue stream that I hope all of us would honor in deferred maintenance to extend the life cycle and the livelihood of those particular facilities. So specifically, Representative Kawasaki, the legislature is the appropriation body. It can use that. This is trying to place in front of future legislators deferred maintenance as a priority issue versus new construction. This fund has been typically used for increased capital budget funding. This would increase capital fund, but ask the legislature to consider deferred maintenance before other projects.
Okay. So just to clarify, this can't dedicate future legislatures, but the idea would be that a legislative committee in the future will say, well, that really is supposed to be set aside for the things that we currently own, not new buildings.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, that's the intent and the goal, and I hope that you all could support that or at least consider that should be our highest and best use of that money at this particular point in our history.
And just one more.
Follow-up, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And do we know how much money is currently in the Alaska Capital Income Fund?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, about $26 million is rolled off. I think it's $23 to $26 million annually. It was about a 6% interest return rate that was rolled off this year.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Senator McKenna, thank you very much for being here and for bringing this bill forward. It's one of my concerns for many years is the deferred maintenance that we have in this state that has to be addressed. It's either that or buy blue tarps and put them on buildings, because we're going to start losing buildings if we don't. You answered one of my questions. You said about $26 million was generated in earnings this year. Again, it depends on the market, of course, but I think this is a start. We need about $100 million a year minimum to get deferred maintenance taken care of. And this is a start, and I really appreciate you bringing this bill forward. Thank you very much.
I also want to note that also available to answer questions is Adam Bryan, Capital Budget Coordinator at the Office of Management and Budget. And so with that, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so how would you say the prioritization part of it work? Did you say it was going to be based on some type of list?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the capital budget chairman take the budget that is offered from the governor and evaluate the use of reappropriations or general fund dollars every year. This is a fund that they have accessed and started to spend from, I believe. I hope I'm not speaking inaccurately, for whatever one would want to spend it on these days. And so this is a way that the legislature could come together by both bodies and recognize that we have so many facilities out there, and as Representative Kawasaki and Representative Thompson have said, to prioritize those facilities so that we can continue their life.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up?
Because maybe it was I thought you were prioritizing actual projects. Maybe you're just talking about all in all. Is there any way, as part of it, when I cut across the state building and the library moved out of there and moved over, it's like nobody cleaned it up afterwards. And it kind of makes me wonder, you know, besides just looking at maintenance, are we also looking at whether or not we even need the buildings any longer, or, you know, is there a possibility to do that? Because we do have a lot of buildings and we're spread out with a pretty big footprint. I'm not too sure that's still is necessary. Is there any place, I know it's not necessarily in this bill, but whose responsibility kind of is that to start seeing whether or not we need to have so many buildings?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the state does prioritize projects in the STIP, the Statewide Transportation Improvement Plan, and there are other ways that each of the agencies prioritize projects for the buildings that they own. But we aren't choosing to do that in this bill. That happens at the appropriation table with the involvement of your body as well as the involvement of the Senate. Specifically to the need of future buildings, the Senate Finance Committee had a meeting with the administration and specifically with DOT, who's in charge of facilities, and asked that specific question. We asked, of the 2,200 buildings that we own, is there a way that we could prioritize the usefulness of the building and whether it would be more appropriate to have that facility in private hands versus on off the tax rolls, per se, in individual communities and back into the hands of the private sector. So we ask them to go through that process, but it is an administrative function, and some of the buildings need to go through a more formal process. I think of the Alaska Psychiatric Facility, and if you're looking at doing something different, there's a larger process that you have to go through before you can dispose of some of those assets.
Thank you.
Representative Newman and then Seaton.
Thank you and welcome, Senator. Spent a lot of time with you in this room one time. Senator, I'm just trying to figure out why we need this bill. You know, we already have the appropriations authority to do this, and to me, this is giving away our appropriation authority. And it's optional, as you say. First off, you know, and the second word is may, so money may be appropriated. So this is advisory or optional for the legislature. It's very clear on that to start with. Second, we can put as much money towards deferred maintenance as we want, and I certainly understand maintenance. I was in the building maintenance. I've done that in my past for a living. I get it. It's a lot cheaper to fix the roof than to build a new building. But we have a lot of needs in the state, from troopers to everything else that we need. And again, I was just trying to wrap my hands, and I've looked at this a lot of different ways as to why we need this bill. And I can't come to a solid answer on that. I know that is it just primarily you feel there's a real need for maintenance, building maintenance, deferred maintenance to be funded, and you want to ensure that that happens? Is that the gist of where we're going on this? You want to put some light on that?
Chairman Foster, through the chair, Representative Newman, Alaska has a huge backlog of deferred maintenance. So the primary focus of the bill is to put a highlight on that problem and provide a revenue stream that all of us in the legislature would honor. It also highlights the need to a future administration that we do not approve of reprioritizing this funding stream for something other than deferred maintenance. And as Representative Thompson said, it provides a small funding stream that would be reoccurring that needs to have more money wrapped with it. So, yes, it's a way to highlight, but I would point to one other issue, and I've said this when I presented another bill from the Senate Finance team. Through the chair, Representative Newman, we are being watched by national credit rating agencies, and there are very few things that we can come together on easily. And so you are absolutely right that May is there because we have to allow future legislatures to be able to define themselves and to prioritize how they want to prioritize things. But why wouldn't we want to put our best foot forward with what we should be doing now, and that is maintaining the facilities that we have and show the international or the national markets that are looking at Alaska that we are doing what's right, even if it's small steps together, whether it's reducing the size of the appropriation ability from $5 billion to $2.5 billion, or whether it's dedicating an average of $25 million a year to deferred maintenance. It's the step in the right direction. So you're absolutely right. We have the authority to do this. This is a public statement to tell Alaskans that we take our job very seriously and that we're not building new buildings, even though many of us would like to in our home communities, but we are going to try to take care of the assets that we have so Alaskans can enjoy them, and that the money that we've already invested in them can be maintained for that useful life. So I appreciate the question. I agree with you that you don't have to do this, but I believe, and the Senate Finance team believes, that it's a step in the right direction to prioritize use of these funds for deferred maintenance.
Follow-up, Representative Newman.
I guess another question. Senator, by removing the words any public purpose, I'm assuming that your intent is that the capital income fund should not be used for anything, any public purpose.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, any future legislature can do anything they want to allocate, whether this language is adopted or the current language. What this would do is highlight deferred maintenance as a priority of the 30th legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I'd like to recognize that we're joined in the audience by Representative Reinbold. We've got a question from Representative Seaton and then Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome.
Thank you.
Senator McKinn. If this is to provide a revenue stream for ongoing maintenance or deferred maintenance, is it the intention that this would then become part of the operating budget, or would it remain part, or would it stay part of the capital budget instead if it's going to be an ongoing stream for providing maintenance?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, as a capital budget chairman, I certainly hope it stays in the capital budget so that you could prioritize life cycles on buildings and make sure that funding is designated to continue the life of an investment that we've already made. Any future legislature could use it in the operating budget as they could today. It's a revenue stream that is at each of our body's disposal.
Thank you. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Senator McKinnon. The close to $2 billion backlog in maintenance, I don't think it's that sexy for people, but I think you understand, and many of us understand, that if we don't address it, it's just going to cost more the more we let the roofs leak and the buildings rot. So I have some sympathy there. I guess my question, though, really is, I'm going to feel I don't want to vote for I don't want to vote for something that would be empty legislation, and I'm not saying this is empty, but our average capital budgets in the past, just state funding, has been about $600 million a year. Nobody says we can afford that right now. There was some waste in some of those capital budgets. But even if we did half of that, that would be $300 million, and with where we are with no agreed-upon fiscal plan, our capital budgets have been less than $100 million. So I just don't see, until we do the fiscal plan part of it, I don't see how we ever get to the $2 billion of deferred maintenance, even with changing the statute. I guess, what would you say to that?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the capital budgets have been close to $1 billion for the state of Alaska. We've leveraged over $100 million each year. I believe last year's total was approximately $115 million. dollars. Alaska lost a huge portion of its revenue stream with the fall in price on oil and a decline of oil production. You know that better than, well, this whole team knows that better than a lot of others might. That being said, we still should do what's right for the properties that we own if we're going to own them. And through the chair, Representative Guerra, if not, like Representative Wilson, we should start selling them so that someone enjoys the life of the product. So I think that we all should highlight what we can do to work together. I personally want to work together on a fiscal plan that helps Alaska. As a person that just got into leadership when the price of oil fell and production was falling at the same time and Alaska lost billions of dollars worth of revenue, I have a capital budget that I struggle even putting out the $100 million. It is not like when I sat in the chair that you're sitting in today as the vice chairman in this body, where we were investing in Alaskan communities by the tune of $1 billion worth of state funds. I'm sad to say that that's not a position that we're in right now, but this is a step in the right direction to at least provide some funding left to the co-chairs, certainly, and to the committee members that look at these things and try to prioritize deferred maintenance. But like you, I would like a larger capital budget. I just can't recommend that to my team at this time because of the fiscal uncertainty and a $10 billion draw from Alaska's savings over the last 5 years. And we're looking at another $2.4 billion coming out of our savings account. So I felt like I got the purse when there was nothing in it as a capital budget chairman, and I've had to say no and only been able to say yes to two projects in the entire time that I've been the capital budget chairman.
Representative Guerra?
I think that puts you in the company of Governor Walker and the last president who came in with the bad timing also. I'm sympathetic to the idea, right? I mean, I'm glad you took on an issue that's really not that interesting to folks outside of this building, which is $2 billion of deferred maintenance that we have to get to. I just don't see getting to it with the bill only, but I understand why you introduced the bill. But if we're going to have the kinds of capital budgets we've had the last couple of years, we're just never going to get there. So I look forward to working with you.
We have any further questions of the committee? Seeing no further questions, thank you, Senator McKinnon. So we're going to go ahead and set the bill aside for now. And our next regularly scheduled House Finance Committee meeting is tomorrow, Wednesday, May 3rd at 1:30 p.m. And at this meeting, we'll have presentations from the industry leaders and municipal leaders and an introduction of SB 32, which is the Prescriptions for Biological Products Bill. So at this time, we will be adjourned at 4:05 p.m. Thank you.